Today's scripture reading comes from Luke 24, verses 1 through 12. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee? The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again." Then the women remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
In the Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize winning play by Arthur Miller, The Death of a Salesman, an aging Willie Loman faces the realities of his life that did not match up to his expectations of success. He spent his career as a traveling salesman based in New York, who now at age 63 is disappointed with himself, with his family, and with his two sons. He sees his life as this book with a great cover and an intriguing table of contents, but empty pages between the book covers. The play tells the story of how Willie attempts to come to terms with his deteriorating mental health and inability to continue his line of work. And when he goes to ask his boss for a change in position so he can stay in town, he ends up getting fired. He loses his job. He is estranged from his two sons. And one son, along the way, discovers that Willie has been cheating in the marriage with a woman during his business trips to Boston. Everything is crumbling. And in Willie's mind, the only way out is to face death himself so that his insurance policy can support his family. Willie faced a series of deaths before his ultimate death. You know, like Willie, we all face a series of deaths before our ultimate physical death. Like Willie, we may experience the death of a career dream, or the death of a significant relationship, a death to a dream of success for loved ones. You know, part of our humanity is confronting these deaths that we face in our lives along the journey. And how do we voice our response to these deaths? In Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar says regarding death, "Cowards die many times before their deaths, but the valiant ones never taste death by once." In other words, heroes die once gloriously, while cowards die many times over in their fear. But is this the only way of approaching death in our humanity? That to face death like a hero is the only way of living? In our Words of Humanity series, we have been looking at expressions of our humanity in the Easter story, and particularly at how Jesus meets us in these longings of humanity. In today's message, we will explore the significance of the tomb and how to come to terms with an empty tomb, and finally, seeing what lies beyond an empty tomb, especially when there is a resurrected Jesus involved. First, the tomb. You know, tombs represent death. They are where the dead are laid to rest. And for many of us who have lost loved ones, tombs represent a point of connection or of acknowledging grief and of remembering the life of the loved one and all that they meant to us. You know, some of us may go regularly to a graveside to connect a sense of place with the one that we love and remember. And this seems to be what's going on with the woman as they go early morning on the very first Easter Sunday. We're told in verse 1, on the very first day of the week, very early in the morning, the woman took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. Luke tells us in the previous chapter that on the day that Jesus was buried, the woman had gone with him and followed and saw the tomb and where his body was laid. They had been there at least once already. And in contrast to John's account that tells us only Mary Magdalene went alone, Luke tells us in verse 10 of the passage we read that it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them, at least five in total. The women went with spices to honor the dead. They had no expectations except to come upon the tomb, which held the body of Jesus, despite Jesus having predicted several times in the stories before. Two of his greatest stories had ended with a strong reference to rising from the dead, chapter 15 and in chapter 16. But nobody had really heard what Jesus was saying. The women arrived at the tomb of Jesus to honor their memory of him, but it was more than a tomb for his body. The tomb represented the deaths of these hopes and dreams. The tombs represented the finality of their expectations. Later on in the chapter, we see more about these expectations when the men on the Emmaus Road speak with Jesus. We're told there that in verse 19 and 20, concerning Jesus, he was a prophet, powerful in the word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. For these men on the road to Emmaus, Jesus' death was also the death to their political dreams for Israel. The tomb represented a determined finality to that dream. You know, when I drive home, one route takes me under the 295 highway where it crosses the Pennsylvania Avenue Bridge. There's a small roadside vigil that remains there in place of to remember one homeless woman named Angela Hill, who lived there for many years. She passed away in her sleep this February during one of the cold snaps. And even though she had family and friends who cared for her, and the DC Health and Health Services had attempted to house her, because of her mental health concerns, she always returned to that place as a place of comfort. Now, I don't know where she ended up being buried, but this particular location and this place under the bridge and the flowers laid there now remind me of her life every time I drive by that place. She is one who is made in the image of God, but now she is no longer with us. You know, what kind of tombs remind you of death in your lives? You know, we all have them if we're honest with ourselves, whether it's the death of a loved one or the death of a dream. We often encounter tombs of sorts in our lives that serve as reminders of these deaths that we experience in our lives. It could be an old photo of a relationship that is no longer. Or our resume becomes a tomb of sorts for a career trajectory that we had imagined for ourselves. A report card, especially one with an F on it, becomes a tomb for a failed course. Our inactive social media feeds become a tomb for how interesting we thought our lives to be. A folder of art or of our writing becomes a tomb for an aspiring creative endeavor. The women in the resurrection story remind us that facing the tombs in our lives is something we all can do. The Christian faith gives us an honest view of death and loss that is unique in our world. And though they may seem final, they don't have to be definitive for the rest of our lives. We can express our grief. We can express our loss. The Easter story reminds us that when God is at work, our tombs aren't always what they seem. Nadia Boetz-Weber helpfully reflects on this passage, saying, "Sometimes tombs are about how we treat things in our life, and though they represent the end, this relationship is over. This life of faith has ended. This time of happiness will never return. There's a big stone covering the thing I used to feel, or I used to love, or I used to be. And anyway, it started to smell of rot. That part of me is totally dead. Period. End of sentence. End quote. You know, there's a saying that comes from our African-American preachers. It says, where we put a period, God puts a comma. Where we put a period, God puts a comma. You know, having a God of the resurrection means that the story is seldom over when we think it is. What we think are periods on our stories are merely commas in God's story. And like the woman who approached the tomb expecting the end of their leader's life and how their leader would lead, they found the stone had been rolled away. The tomb they came upon was empty. And how did they respond? Well, in verse 4, we're told that they were perplexed about this. They were confounded. And in verse 11, we're told that the men, the disciples, did not believe the women. So Peter gets up and runs to the tomb himself. We often have expectations of finality in the tombs we see in our lives, but God surprises us with an empty tomb. The women are perplexed about the situation. The women tell the disciples, and the men think about it, and they're shocked and surprised. They could not believe it was possible because the nature of Jesus' resurrection did not match with their expectations, and also because Jewish culture discounted the testimony of women compared to that of men. So Peter had to go and verify for himself. And isn't that something remarkable about this scene of the empty tomb? Even the reporting of the event was a death of sorts. The fact that the resurrected Jesus entrusted the story to these women was a death to the expectations of culture in Jesus' time. The male leaders didn't get to control all the narrative. The angels and the resurrected Jesus reveal themselves first to the women as an affirmation of their value and of their role in this new era of humanity that Jesus was now beginning. This was something unheard of in their culture. And as you read the post-resurrection occurrences of Jesus, these early moments indicate that even the women couldn't believe it. They had a strong sense of doubt about their news and about their role in it. Theirs and the disciples' response wasn't as embracing as we might have imagined. You could say it was actually quite contemporary in their response. It was filled with skepticism. They needed to be repeated for them to be convinced that Jesus indeed had been raised. You know, when Julie and I first got married, there were a number of things that I had to die to that surprised me. You know, there are of course the usual things that many newly married couples have to die to. There's the death to complete financial independence as an individual, spending your money however you want to spend. There's the death to living according to your own schedule, sleeping when you want, eating the kinds of foods that you want. There's death to the timelines for your career and professional development as you now share your goals and your life with another person that you've committed to share the rest of your life with and likely begin a family with. But I had to die to how I understood conflict was resolved. You know, I loved the family I grew up with. My parents loved God and loved my sister and I. They sought to model a life where serving God and caring for others was a tangible part of our regular weekly rhythms as a family. But we weren't very effective in communicating when there was conflict. So when Julie and I first got married, it was inevitable that we had a disagreement about something. And I don't even remember what we disagreed about, but I do remember how we disagreed about it. Or namely, how I disagreed about it. Because all of a sudden, in our conversation that began to escalate, Julia disengaged and said, "Why are you yelling at me?" To which I responded, "What? I'm not yelling. I'm just making my point." In my relationship with Julia, I had to die to this way of communicating that I didn't even realize was part of me for 30 years. thinking, what do you mean I can't express myself? What's your problem? Why are you so sensitive? You know, I was confronting the tomb of my expectations for dealing with conflict and realizing that those expectations were coming up empty. The empty tomb, in this case, revealed that how I approached conflict wasn't going to lead to the life and to the deeper enjoyment of not only my relationship with Julia, but also with others that I would inevitably conflict with. In my family, we often resorted to raising our voices in conflict. You know, looking back, I realized that a lot of that was because we weren't very aware of our emotions. We didn't know how to express what we were feeling. And we didn't know how to identify what the other person was doing that was causing us grief. And so the only way we knew how to voice our displeasure in a situation was to raise our voices as loudly as we knew how. You know, in that moment of confronting the tomb of how I dealt with conflict, I was surprised. I couldn't imagine a different way of dealing with conflict. I was skeptical. I needed to encounter a different way of dealing with conflict repeatedly before I embraced that reality. And thanks to Julia's patience, I think I've come a long way. You know, in God's grace, Jesus too met me as I confronted that empty tomb and assured me of a different way of looking at myself and at others. The resurrected Jesus showed me that this old self of Andrew had to die and to live into this new way of approaching conflict that reflected Jesus's character. Raising my voice didn't have to be the only way of responding to conflict. And sure, I had to go through bouts of asserting and saying to myself, well, I'm just being expressive. This is the way God made me. I can't help it if I feel this way. You know, we all do those kinds of excuses and rationalizations, but the risen Jesus kept coming to me, kept coming alongside of me, pointing to a life of what it looks like to follow in his footsteps. The resurrected Jesus allowed me to become more human in how I reacted to conflict and more humane in how I treated others I was in conflict with. And I think this is the beauty of the Easter story and why it matters so much. We can confront our ultimate physical death, but we can also encounter those thousands and thousands of deaths to our ego-driven selves that will take place through the course of our lives. We don't have to be afraid of them. We don't have to be incapacitated by them. But please hear me. The Easter story is not just meant to be merely allegorized as an inspirational story for personal development. Because if that's what you see the Christian faith to be, then functionally, you remain the God of your life. You and your ego still remain in the driver's seat, even if it is well-intended to become a better person, and even if you use the language of God and of faith. The living God of Scripture doesn't call the shots in these situations. You still do. But the Christian faith is grounded in this historical event of a Jesus who lived the perfect life that we could not live and died the death that we deserved to die because of this self-oriented, self-justifying instinct that we all experience. And that's what the Bible calls sin. And Jesus physically rose from the grave to a resurrected life and is now ascended to be in the physical presence of God the Father. Jesus' resurrection changes everything. It changes the created order. And Jesus' resurrection changes the trajectory of history towards what the Bible calls a new creation. And we get to be a part of that when we trust in this story. Jesus' resurrection proves that a new way of living is possible, no matter how hard it is to confront the empty tombs that we will inevitably face in our lives. And that's why the Easter story is good news, not just good advice or a good story. It's good news that must be received and we are compelled to share. Beyond the empty tomb, where does that take us? The empty tomb is not just a personal mystical experience, because if it were so, then the woman would have shared it just as that, that they had a personal experience of divine connection that met them in their grief when they went to the tomb. But they didn't return to the disciples saying, oh, you really must come to the garden because I just felt so close to God there. And they didn't really say, you must really come to church and engage in these spiritual disciplines because God's divine presence was felt so much there. It was much more than that. They were told by the angels and by Jesus to go and tell the disciples not about a personal spiritual experience, but about the fact that the tomb was indeed empty, that Jesus really rose from the dead, and that Jesus is going ahead of you to Galilee. In Luke's account, as I mentioned earlier, just after this scene, we're told of two men who are walking that very same day and talking about the resurrection. They're doing the 7-mile walk from Jerusalem to a town called Emmaus, and Jesus comes alongside of them and begins to walk with them, but they don't recognize him. On this walk, they're processing the news of this empty tomb and to the loss of their beloved leader. And for these two men, the empty tomb confounded their expectations of, quote, one who would redeem Israel, close quote. They, like the disciples and the woman, expected Jesus to be a political leader to restore Israel to its rightful place as God's blessed nation in the world. For them, and for many Jews, the good news of the Messiah arriving was to make their people great again. That was their expectation. The good news, according to their expectations, was some sense of God's blessing upon them as God's people. But the good news that they are compelled to share is not the restoration of Israel, or that they had a mystical spiritual experience, or that they had found strength to work through grief in their lives. The good news that they share is that Jesus is alive. He is risen, and he has appeared to us, and this news changes everything. That's the news that they are asked to share. And so when the men hurry back the next morning, they go back to Jerusalem to tell the disciples about this encounter. We find that Jesus shows up again there in that room. Luke makes it clear that this appearance of Jesus isn't a ghost, and it's not a mystical experience shared by a group of people practicing some religion. Jesus is there fully in the body. He shows his wounded hands and feet that the disciples can touch. And he comes with an empty stomach that hungers for food for them to fill. And he says to them in verse 28, you are witnesses of these things. I am going to send you what my Father has promised, but stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high. This is the good news of Easter, that Jesus commands each of his followers to share. If you trust in the good news of the risen Jesus of Easter, then you also are compelled to share this good news of the risen Jesus of Easter by the power of God's Spirit and with the power of God's Spirit. The risen Jesus is good news. So I ask you, what kind of good news do you share? You know, Black Lives Matter and Asian Lives Matter is good rhetoric. Ending white supremacy is a good goal. Figuring out how to do reparations well for indigenous people and the descendants of slaves is good policy. Overcoming your fears and trauma is good work for you to do. Contemplative spiritual practices are good habits. You know, a strong economy and vaccination access and a return to in-person activities are types of good news that we look forward to. But it's only the good news of a crucified and resurrected Jesus that points to a new reality that has the power to create all the good news of the world forever. That's why it's good news. My friends, we often see death and tombs and periods at the end of sentences in the stories of our lives. But amidst all those deaths and all those tombs and all those periods, a risen Jesus is at work. God sees opportunity and new life because Jesus is alive. You know, when a farmer looks upon a field, they can either see an empty field as a cropless harvest, or as soil to dig and cultivate for new seeds of life buried beneath. And with the resurrected Jesus, the field that is our lives and our hearts and that is our world is teeming with new opportunity and life, even when there are a multitude of deaths that we must face. The resurrection story reminds us that death doesn't have the final say when we encounter and embrace Jesus on the road we travel. There is life beyond the empty tomb because Jesus, a risen Jesus, goes on ahead of us. So take heart, my friends. Meet the risen Jesus in the tombs of your lives. Do not be afraid of them and walk in this new life that he has come to secure. But even more, share this good news with joy and with confidence because the risen Lord is making all things new. May it be so. Amen.